Hello, I'm Caroline Williams in London.
Hello, I'm Ivan Semenek in Boston.
And this is SciPod, the international science podcast from New Scientist magazine.
This week on the June 3rd edition of SciPod, back to the future. To understand how global warming will affect hurricanes in the years ahead, scientists unearth the surprising history of hurricanes long ago.
Speaking in tongues, how do you know when to say Guten Tag and when to say hello? A new study locates the language switch in the bilingual brain.
Windows on the East. When Bill Gates came to China to set up a research lab, the Cultural Revolution went both ways.
And in science news, Galileo revisited. But instead of throwing cannonballs off the Leaning Tower of Pisa, an astrophysicist says we should be watching the way galaxies fall through space to learn if dark matter feels a hidden fifth force. SciPod. It's not just a podcast, it's an audio scientific revolution. This month marks the start of a new hurricane season in North America, and if it's anything like last year's, it could be both costly and deadly. Hurricanes or typhoons are among the most devastating of natural hazards. On that point, there's no argument. But these days, what climate scientists are trying to establish with increasing urgency is whether or not hurricanes are going to be more severe and more numerous in the future, either through natural cycles or through the effects of global warming. It's a tricky question, and as New Scientist discovered, it's one that has researchers looking into the distant past for clues to the not-so-distant future.
Cam Bu-Lu is no stranger to the power of hurricanes. Last August, he sat in his house and experienced Hurricane Katrina blowing through Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And just 2 weeks ago, nearly 10 months after Katrina, he happened to be driving along Mississippi's Gulf Coast.
The coast was just like the Hiroshima or Nagasaki, you know, after the atomic bomb. There was some reconstruction going on, but still the whole coastline was very much devastated by the hurricane, and I hardly saw a single building or structure that has remained intact.
In fact, Cam Bu-Lu studies hurricanes at Louisiana State University. His research concerns the evidence that hurricanes leave behind. Not the obvious kind of evidence, like blown down buildings and washed out roads, but evidence that speaks across the ages.
What we are trying to do is to develop this new field of science called paleotempestology. It is a relatively young field of science that studies past hurricane activities by means of geological techniques and also archival techniques as well.
The goal of paleotempestology is easy to understand. The more scientists know about hurricane activity in the past, the better they can predict what's likely to happen in the future. The oldest written accounts can be found in China, where Cam Bu-Lu has studied reports dating back 1,000 years. In Louisiana, no such records exist, so he must tease information on ancient hurricanes out of the local geography.
If we can find a lake or a marsh that is situated behind a sandy barrier along a coast, when we have an intense hurricane making landfall, then it will create an overwash event. And as a result, sand will be washed from the sandy barrier and deposited into the bottom of the lake behind it.
By extracting core samples from the bottoms of these coastal lakes, Cam Bu-Lu and his colleagues are building up a surprising portrait of hurricane activity that stretches back thousands of years. For example, it suggests that between 3,800 years and 1,000 years ago, hurricanes were stronger and more numerous in the Gulf of Mexico than they are today.
This is what I call the hyperactive period, because we found evidence showing that there was very frequent strikes by catastrophic hurricanes. These are, you know, Cat 4 or Cat 5 hurricanes, very intense hurricanes causing high storm surge and overwash events. And so this is the first piece of evidence that shows that there are millennial cycles in hurricane activities.
Scientists have long known that hurricanes, typhoons, and tropical cyclones all tend to vary in patterns that stretch out over decades. But the revelation that there are much longer cycles, lasting hundreds to thousands of years, means that human experience may be woefully inadequate to prepare us for what lies ahead. This is the chief concern of Jonathan Knott of James Cook University in northeastern Australia. There, a 100-year period of relatively modest cyclone activity was brutally shattered when Tropical Cyclone Larry swept through earlier this year.
One of the biggest problems that we have faced here is that because we've had so few very intense tropical cyclones crossing the east coast in recent years, we've had a lot of coastal development, and also there are many homes that have survived for, you know, 80, 90, 100 years, and they are not built to normal cyclone standards. And so when Larry came through, producing winds, some gusts were recorded close to 300 kilometres an hour, it literally ripped apart numerous homes.
According to Knott, cyclones like Larry are not nearly so exceptional when you consider the paleo record. And in this part of the world, that record leaves a distinct signature.
We have coral reefs, obviously along the Great Barrier Reef in North Queensland, and the branching corals, the more fragile corals, get broken off during these major tempests, and they get pushed up into a ridge along the coast. These ridges can be up to 5 metres high, and they can be many hundreds of metres or kilometres even in length, and we get many of these ridges building up parallel to the shore over the last 5,000 years.
Paleotempestology is still a young science, but its message is already coming through loud and clear. In a nutshell, it says the way things are now is not a good indicator of how they once were or could be again. And this is particularly relevant when, thanks to global warming, we're actively changing the world's climate. Jeff Donnelly studies past hurricanes at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. He hopes the work will allow scientists to understand how human activity will impact long-term cycles in hurricane activity.
In order to look at how climate change is impacting hurricanes, we might need much longer data sets. And that's what the geologic record can provide. And so in New England, we're getting records that are several thousand years old, and down in the Caribbean, we're getting records that are 5,000 or 6,000 years old. So we're starting to piece together that really long-term history. And by looking at these patterns, we can start to try to figure out what climate variables are important in driving the changes in hurricane frequency. And then once we've got that sorted out, we can start thinking about, well, how are those variables likely to change in the future?
Compared to the geological record, the speed at which a single hurricane can change the landscape and change lives forever is breathtakingly fast. But to understand how hurricanes are likely to affect us in the future, scientists have learned to take the long view. They've come to realize that through the complex and ancient rhythms of ocean and atmosphere, our planet is speaking to us. Our ability to avert future disasters will likely depend on how well we can listen.
And if you'd like to know more about the emerging science of tempestology, all you have to do is breeze over to this week's issue of New Scientist magazine.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Ci sono cinque pianeti visibili nel cielo a occhio nudo. Il y a cinq planètes visibles dans le ciel à l'œil nu.
There are 5 planets visible in the night sky to the naked eye.
You've just heard the same person expressing the same idea in 3 different languages. Scientists know that people who are multilingual don't actually store concepts like planet or visible multiple times in their brains. Instead, they can access those concepts via different language pathways. But how does the brain control which language it's using at any given moment? Research published this week in the journal Science sheds new light on this question. To find out more, Caroline met with 2 of the study's co-authors. Dr. Kathy Price and Dr. David Green are at the Institute for Neurology, part of University College London.
So, Dr. Price and Dr. Green, thanks very much for joining us. Now, it seems quite miraculous to me that if I'm bilingual in, say, English and Japanese, and somebody speaks to me in either language, I can switch between one and the other and make perfect sense of it. From the psychology and brain point of view, why did it interest you?
Well, I think the real issue for us is we're trying to understand how language is controlled. And one of the main phenomena is, as you say, that bilinguals or multilingual speakers can switch between languages. And exactly how they do that can inform us about the brain mechanisms involved. And we're also interested in following that up in terms of what happens as a function of stroke in patients who are bilingual or multilingual.
Many studies have shown that the same network of brain regions are involved irrespective of which language you speak. And that shows that we use a common set of brain regions irrespective of our culture and background. But what it doesn't tell us is how one person is able to switch from one to another. And that's what we were interested in this study.
So how did you go about working that out?
Well, what we wanted to do was to measure activity when the language changed. And we did it by presenting pairs of words where we asked people to focus on the second word, and then we looked at what the effect of the first word was.
So, for example, a pair of words like trout, salmon, related words like that?
That's right, yes. And sometimes they were related and sometimes they weren't related. And then we looked to see what the effect of them being related was within the same language, and also when you change language, so you had trout in one language and salmon in another language.
And what did you find when you looked into this?
Well, we searched the whole brain to find an effect, and we came up with just one region that was showing a response to the meaning of the words, irrespective of which language was being presented. But in addition, it was increasing its response if there was a change in the language. So even if there were two words that meant exactly the same thing, there was more activity if there was a change in language. And that fitted with what we were looking for, and would be consistent with the type of mechanisms that might control a switch in language.
So is this the language switch that you were looking for?
Well, we view it as part of the switching mechanism. And I think one of the interesting things, and Kathy will perhaps say more about this in a moment, is that what our results show is the important role that subcortical structures, because the chordate is part of a subcortical structure. And our view is that the subcortex plus other structures play a role in switching.
So there may be other components to this that you've yet to find?
Yes, components of a circuit, if you like, or a set of circuits that are actually involved in switching, yeah.
And now that we found the chordate, it's very clear where the chordate connects to. We'll be able to actually start tracing the connections to the chordate, and we can start measuring how the connections between regions, or how they talk to each other, change in bilinguals and monolinguals. So by highlighting this region, it allows us to focus our future studies on looking at how this region is talking to other regions of the brain.
So what does all this mean for the study of the brain?
I think, first of all, we're not wanting to say that this is a mechanism that is distinctive to bilinguals. I mean, it's likely that monolingual speakers who are able to speak in different registers, for example, say different kinds of words to children as opposed to adults, to professional colleagues as opposed to lay people, that kind of mechanism is also, we believe, involved in that kind of activity as well.
So when you're sort of talking to friends maybe down the pub, you'd use a different language to what you're using to your colleagues talking about neurology. So there's switching going on there too.
Yes. And we also think that this kind of mechanism may be part of a more general mechanism that's associated with action.
In choosing what to do next?
Yes, yes.
Coming to the conclusion that the left chordate was involved in this, was that a surprise to you, or were there any indications before that it might be involved?
Well, there is an indication that can be involved, which is in a patient, there are several reports of patients who have damage around the left chordate and have difficulty with their speech. And in particular, there's a very interesting report of a patient who was able to speak three languages. And when she was asked to name pictures in these languages, she couldn't control which language she was speaking in. So she would tend to switch backwards and forwards from one language to another. And she was aware that she was doing it, but she couldn't control that. So that was very consistent with the fact that this region is important. But this was just one case, and you can't always tell from lesion studies whether it's the damage to that area itself or whether that area has disconnected other regions of the brain that are important. So the two studies together, our functional imaging study and the patient study, actually fit very nicely and sort of provide sort of double argument for it.
So now that you've got these two pieces of evidence that seem to point to one area of the brain, what's next?
Well, I think as Kathy said earlier, one of the things we're interested in is pursuing the nature of those connections. Also, of course, we would be interested in discovering the consequences of lesions in different parts of that circuit and how that influences a bilingual and multilingual's ability to switch or maintain speech in one language rather than another.
So there's plenty yet still to do.
Certainly.
Yes.
Well, thanks very much, Dr. Price and Dr. Green, for joining us. I'm sure all of our bilingual listeners and monolingual listeners will be glad to know that their switch is in working order. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye. And if you speak more than one language and would like to be involved in future studies, Dr. Kathy Price invites you to contact her at the Institute for Neurology. Her email is c.price@fil.ion.ucl.ac.uk.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
And now it's time for this week's science news.
When Galileo allegedly dropped two cannonballs of different weights from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, he was testing how matter behaves in a gravitational field. Now, a similar test involving entire galaxies could reveal if dark matter is subject to an extra force in addition to gravity. Dark matter is the unknown substance that makes up 90% of the mass in the universe. In a typical galaxy like the Milky Way, it takes the form of an invisible halo surrounding the galaxy's disk of stars. In theory, dark matter only interacts with normal matter through gravity. But according to Mike Keesden, a researcher at the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics, dark matter may also interact with itself through an additional force. To test if this force is real, Keston says astronomers should look to the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy, a small satellite galaxy that's being reeled in by the Milky Way.
The idea is that as this satellite kind of falls into the larger galaxy, the gravity is still completely present. So gravitationally, both the larger galaxy and its dark matter halo are gravitationally attracting the satellite, both the matter and the dark matter in the satellite. However, if there's this additional kind of dark matter force, then the dark matter in the larger galaxy will have this additional attraction to the dark matter in the satellite galaxy.
If an extra force on dark matter exists, then the dark matter in the core of the Sagittarius dwarf should move more quickly than expected, dragging the stars in the core along with it. Meanwhile, stars that are far from the core of the Sagittarius dwarf are much less affected by the dark matter, and so should move differently. The overall effect will be the reverse of Galileo's experiment, where two cannonballs fall at the same rate. Keston says astronomers should take a closer look at the Sagittarius dwarf to see if there's any sign of a dark matter force. Now from dwarf galaxies to dwarf dinosaurs. German researchers have discovered that dinosaurs as small as 6 metres long once roamed islands in present-day Central Europe. Ironically, these miniature dinosaurs are sauropods, the family which includes the largest animals ever to walk the Earth. Scientists have known of possible dwarf dinosaurs since the late 19th century, but this new species, called Europosaurus, is the first to have its dwarf status confirmed by looking at growth marks on its bones. These growth marks are like tree rings, and the spaces between them gets narrower as an individual reaches adulthood. The researchers used these growth marks to show that Europosaurus fossils were indeed from an adult dwarf, rather than a baby dinosaur of normal size. Large animals living on islands often evolve into smaller dwarf forms to better survive on the island's limited food supplies. And finally, if you want to attract attention, get angry. New research shows that both men and women respond to angry faces more quickly to other facial expressions, and men react to the faces of angry men most quickly of all. Scientists from MIT and the University of Melbourne in Australia timed the reactions of 78 male and 78 female subjects to different facial expressions, from sad to neutral to frightened or angry. Not only did angry expressions get the quickest reactions, but adding other faces to the display as a distraction didn't slow people's reaction times for angry faces as it did for more neutral expressions. Scientists say that because an angry person might become a physical threat, it makes sense that evolution would put a premium on recognizing angry faces. The study also found that women reacted more quickly to socially relevant expressions, such as sadness or happiness.
We hope you're enjoying this week's episode of SciPod, and we love hearing from you. So if you've got a comment or a question about this week's show, or about anything to do with our podcast, it's easy to reach us. Just send your message to podcast@newscientist.com. And thanks again for listening.
It's half a world away from Microsoft headquarters, and a world apart from the corporate culture of the West. But according to Bob Buderi and Greg Huang, it's the place where Bill Gates' dreams come true. That place is the Microsoft Research Lab in Beijing. In a new book called Guanxi, The Art of Relationships, Buderi and Huang tell the stories of the people behind the lab and discuss how it could be the template for a high-tech future in which China takes a leading role. Bob Buderi is a research fellow at MIT's Center for International Studies. Greg Huang is a writer and editor with New Scientist. They met with Ivan in Boston.
So, Greg, I think this is one of those conversations where we have to start with the title of the book. What does Guanxi mean, and what does it have to do with Bill Gates?
Guanxi is the Chinese word for the art of relationships, and it's so important because in China today, there's still no such thing as a purely business relationship or purely professional. You have to learn to blend both the personal and the professional side and nurture that over time. And it's so key for high tech, for all kinds of business, and in Bill Gates' case, I mean, it's really the key to unlocking, you know, this future gold mine of talent as well as a market for Microsoft.
Now, it seems like this is a story that has some very interesting people in it. In particular, I'm thinking of Kai-Fu Lee. So, Bob, who is he exactly, and how does he play into this story?
Well, Kai-Fu Lee was the founder of the research lab, its first managing director, but he was born in Taiwan and educated in the United States. He'd written a very important doctoral thesis on speech recognition at Carnegie Mellon, been hired by Apple and Silicon Graphics. So he was actually the perfect recruit for Microsoft because he had this research background, he had Western R&D management experience, and most importantly of all, he had this passion to give back to China. His father had been an administrator in the nationalist government that was overthrown by Mao and had to flee to Taiwan for his life, and it was a very compelling story about how Lee's mother and siblings made their way out. And yet through all this, Lee burned with this passion to give back to China and help lift it up.
But it can't have been easy. Just the cultural differences alone seem so daunting to try and set up that kind of creative, individualistic, Western-style research lab in a place like Beijing. What were the obstacles that Microsoft encountered?
One of the huge cultural clashes that no one really anticipated at the depth that they encountered it was the difference in how the Chinese education system prepared students for careers compared to the West. The Chinese students were very used to taking tests and following specific instructions. They were great at that, but they weren't good at the kind of creativity and initiative that Western R&D managers were looking for in their PhD recruits. So it was really important for Microsoft and for Kai-Fu Lee to recruit Chinese-speaking researchers and managers who'd been trained in the West and could come and act as mentors and bridges to help the Chinese recruits really get it and make the transition. It's a process that typically would take 2 years for a student to master or to get good at in order to become a really participating member of the lab. So you could see that from the start they had to have this much longer time horizon.
Now, of course, you both had to spend some time in China to do research for the book. What is it like to be there, to be immersed in that culture?
Yeah, China has just changed so much in the last 5 or 10 years. We did, between the two of us, we made 5 extended trips to China and you know, largely centered around Beijing, but also traveling around the country, sort of just following our characters as they went about their business. And I mean, I don't know, some of the things that strike me about China, just how hungry the young researchers are and the students, how hard they're willing to work, the kind of hours they keep, and the sense of family in the lab. I mean, especially in the earlier days, and you know, now the lab is up to 200 people plus, you know, a 300 strong development arm, but there's actually still a sense of community there that you don't see in a lot of corporate research labs in the West.
Yeah, I echo that. The hunger in China, really, it's like Silicon Valley in the 80s when everybody was just so proud of how many hours they worked. And you know, there's money flowing, there's deals being made, there's entrepreneurialism, there's big companies, there's hot markets like wireless. Things are just happening at this breakneck pace. And the passion to take part in, not just the way companies like Microsoft used to do business was they would invent something in the U.S. and then they would spiral it off to Europe and localize it in China. Now they're actually creating it in China.
Now, I think this also is raising an interesting philosophical question. Here we've got a really formidable economy. It's a nation that's adopting the architecture of capitalism, but in many ways, especially politically, it's very closed. So what is this telling us about how science works or doesn't work in these different political systems?
I think you definitely have to consider sort of the power of history and culture in understanding, you know, what the future of science and technology is going to be, especially in China. And one thing is that the whole Communist Party is and communist rule is still it's a relatively recent thing. This is, you're talking about 50 years, you know, in the context of 4,000 years of Chinese history. So there, politically, you know, it is a closed system. But more and more, I think you talk to the young people there and a lot of the officials as well, there's just a lot of progressive thinking, and they want to learn what they can from the West. They want to take the best practices of the West in terms of education, in terms of R&D, in terms of management. And they want to try to apply that and you know, make themselves into a top player in the world.
You know, one of the interesting ironies in the book is that Kai-Fu Lee, who's so central to Microsoft in realizing its vision in China, he ultimately leaves Microsoft, and that happened just last year. Tell us about that part of the story. What happened to Kai-Fu Lee?
Kai-Fu Lee had heard that Google was trying to get into China with an R&D lab, and he sent an email to the CEO, Eric Schmidt, and said, "I can help." He wanted to get back to China. He had some differences inside Microsoft. And what happened was really a testament to this whole movement. Is he was offered a deal that was worth about $10 million to go do for Google what he'd just done for Microsoft, and that is open an R&D lab in Beijing. And if ever there was a validation of the power of what Microsoft had done 8 years ago, this was it.
So now Google and Microsoft are both in China in a big way. How does that change the dynamic, and how do you think it'll affect what happens next, Greg?
Well, I think it's going to be a good thing for search technology, a good thing for both companies, Microsoft and Google, and a good thing for China as well. In terms of now you don't just have one, you know, large computer science lab that's competing for talent. Now you have at least two, and surely more than that. And so, but if you look at the future of the web and of search, I mean, one thing that's obvious is that there's just so much content on the web and growing amount of it that's not going to be in English. And so it's really important to be on the ground in different countries, and especially in China, where you're going to develop technologies in multilingual web search. So I think that's going to be a major battleground between these two companies.
I was going to ask you, Bob, if you think that the West has reason to worry. I mean, that's sort of the perpetual question everyone asks, or is that too narrow a view?
I think it's too narrow a view. I think maybe individual companies have reasons to worry. People that don't invest in their future in the right way, companies that don't always lose out in the long run, those that do find ways to invest successfully and adapt to a changing world, they thrive. And I think it's true for nations, too. If you try to close off to the changes taking place in the world, you're not going to succeed. If you try to embrace them and find ways to for everyone to win, then everyone does win. And that's the promise. It makes the world more integrated, more peaceful. It accelerates the science and technology. It brings new applications and uses and to everyone. And so that's the great promise. And you know, the great danger is that we close our minds to change and don't accept these forces at work, and we put up barriers instead of bringing them down.
Well, thanks, guys. It's a really illuminating read. Thanks for talking about it today.
Thank you very much, Ivan.
It's been my pleasure.
And that's all for this episode of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you'll find in the June the 10th issue of New Scientist magazine. Also this week, the slippery slope of networking. With websites like MySpace exploding in popularity, the internet is making it easier than ever to exchange personal information online. And that may be just what the Pentagon wants.
Paving the way for improved DNA. In a tour de force of biotechnology, Japanese researchers correct a genetic defect by inserting an artificial chromosome into a stem cell.
And doing the cosmic twist, why imagining the universe to be a vast rotating superfluid actually makes sense.
This week's edition of SciPod was brought to you by the staff and contributors of New Scientist magazine and NewScientist.com, which this week included Patrick Berry, Claire Bowles, Rowan Hooper, Michael LePage, Matt Walker, and Emma Young. Our technical production is by Bill Oxley, and our theme music was created and performed by the Damn Neighbors.
John McFarlane is the executive producer of SciPod. I'm Caroline Williams.
And I'm Ivan Semenek. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.